From the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., you're listening to Korean Context, news and analysis from the Korean Peninsula. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Korean Context. I'm your host, Jenna Gibson. Today's episode is very relevant to some news that's been going on in the last week or so. Ever since the Singapore summit, we have been waiting for the return of some U.S. soldiers' remains that had been lost in the Korean War and were still in North Korea. Kim Jong-un had promised to return some of those remains, and now, as of last night, they have officially arrived in Hawaii, the remains of 55 servicemen. So with this news, we wanted to dig in a little bit and learn more about what exactly this repatriation process entails. It's a very complicated process. So my guest for this episode has worked directly on this issue, negotiating with the North Koreans and even participating in some recovery trips in North Korea in the 1990s and the 2000s. I'm here with Ashton Orms, who is a retired U.S. Army colonel, an Army Northeast Asia Foreign Area officer, and a former civil servant in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, who was previously involved in efforts to recover the remains of U.S. servicemen from North Korea. Just a quick note, we did record this podcast last week, so we didn't necessarily know that those 55 remains would be returned at that time, but we were able to talk about his experiences and the recovery process in general. So thank you for joining us, and please enjoy the conversation. All right, Ash, thank you so much for your time this afternoon. I'm really excited to talk to you about this very relevant and important topic. Would you mind starting off by telling us how you got involved in the repatriation work and what your role entailed?
I'd be happy to do that, Jen. I spent a good part of my life working this, and it's something that, like many people, I think is quite an important issue and that I care a lot about. Really, I sort of am a bookend of the history of this issue. I'd first started it when we were beginning to talk to the North Koreans about doing recoveries of our missing servicemen that are in North Korea. And I completed it the year after the last joint recovery took place in North Korea. So I had three different assignments in that period. Maybe for background, I worked this issue both as a career U.S. Army officer and then as a civilian in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. When I was in the Army, I became what we call in the Army a Northeast Asia Foreign Area Officer, which means I tried to specialize in general knowledge of Northeast Asia. And my concentration, if you wanted to call it that, in academic sort of terms, was certainly North Korea. That's what I spent all my time really trying to work on. And in 1986, I got a really great assignment. I was a lieutenant colonel at that time, been in the Army for about 16 years, and I was able to become a staff officer in Panmunjom, serving in the United Nations Command and the Military Armistice Commission component of the United Nations Command. We did a lot of things that are the things that you would think about dealing with armistice violations and problems. In those days, we were really the only Americans who were meeting on a regular basis with North Koreans. There was very little State Department contact with North Korea in those days. But a new issue came up. And of course, it was the issue of the remains of Americans in North Korea. And here's how it came up. It's really because of the Vietnam War. At this point, there was a lot of emphasis in the United States and a lot of discussion about our missing men from the wars in Southeast Asia and Vietnam, possibilities that men might have been left behind. But we really weren't doing much for the families of the missing from the Korean War. And in actual numbers, there are more from the Korean War than they were from the Vietnam War. So around 1987, my boss, who was an Army colonel, a mentor of mine named Don Boose, started to implement a policy that the U.S. government and the United Nations Command approved of, which was, let's approach the North Koreans and try to get them to actively go out and search for the remains of these missing Americans. So that's what we would call a unilateral recovery. That's the North Koreans in North Korea looking for the remains of missing Americans, hopefully finding them, disinterring them, and then returning them to us somehow. We weren't successful, but we got the subject on the table and we got the North Koreans thinking about it. I left Panmunjom in 1988, and I came back again 7 years later in 1995. By that time, I was a colonel, And I took over the job that that Colonel Boos had had. I was in charge of that staff section and a job called the Secretary of UNCMAC. It's probably one of the most interesting jobs I ever had. So a lot had happened in the meantime on this issue. Finally, and after Colonel Boos had started these discussions in Panmunjom, the North Koreans in 1990 finally began returning remains that they had unilaterally recovered. And they continued to do so up through 1994. And then we asked them to stop. And I'm sure they were perplexed when we asked them to stop because we had fought so hard to get them to start and convince them that they should be doing this. But the reason that we asked them to stop was that the experts in the identification laboratory said, these remains you're getting from the North Koreans are really, really difficult to identify. We need to go to North Korea, do this work ourselves, because we aren't going to be able to identify these remains. And the whole objective here is to find people, not to get more unknown soldiers. It's to find remains that we can identify and return to their families. So it became my job to convince the North Koreans that we needed to send Americans to North Korea, work with them, that these would be people from the Department of Defense, which you can see their eyebrows raising when you say that, that'll go to North Korea and recover these remains with their cooperation and assistance. It took a while to get them to agree to that, but finally in the spring of 1996, while I was still in Panmunjom, they did agree. The first joint recovery operation took place, and the first remains came back almost to the day because it was a couple days after the signing of the Korean Armistice anniversary. It was in late July, and the program was underway. Come on a little closer in time to 2000. I was no longer in the Army or in Panmunjom, and I'd retired from the Army, and I was able to go to work as a civilian in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. And I was working in an organization that was then called the Defense Prisoner of War Missing Personnel Office, DPMO. It's now been replaced by a newer organization. But DPMO had, ever since 1996, the responsibility for overseeing these joint recovery operations in North Korea. So my role as director of research was, among other things, was to participate in the annual negotiations with the North Koreans where we would set out our agreement of what we'd do in the following year and payments and logistics and that sort of thing, and to go to North Korea at least once a year to observe how the operations were going and come and report back problems that I had seen. And when I did that, I was not surprised to find that the North Koreans on the other side of the table were the same North Koreans I'd known in Panmunjom in 1986 and 87 and then again in 95, 96, 97, because they have a lot of continuity on this issue.
So I'm wondering if you can tell us, maybe people must be really fascinated about the idea of going into North Korea at all, but much less to go and try to get out into these really rural places where there may be remains and you may not know exactly where they are. Can you just give us a little bit of the story of what it's like to go out and try to recover remains in North Korea? I'm sure you've kind of alluded to some of the political issues that arise when you're talking about this issue, but you know, putting that aside, there must be major logistical barriers to getting out and finding these soldiers.
That's an excellent question. From my personal standpoint, as someone who had specialized in trying to understand North Korea, it was fascinating to finally go there. I think a lot of people would feel that way. It was interesting to see North Koreans I'd known in Panmunjom in a different setting. Now I'm in North Korea and in their country, and actually it was less tense up there than it was dealing with them in Panmunjom. But from a logistics standpoint, the people actually doing the work were from, in those days, it was called the Central Identification Laboratory in Hawaii. And they were real experts. They were the same civilian and military specialists who had done this work and were still doing this work in Southeast Asia. So when it came to logistical problems, there were a lot of difficulties, but no barriers. And I really have to praise them. They got the job done. There was never a time where they said, "No, we can't go there. It's too hard to do." They could go anywhere get the job done. They've been to Tibet. They've been to the jungles of Laos and New Guinea. So North Korea was no real challenge to them. But that doesn't mean that there weren't some pretty significant challenges. The first thing that we had to do, and that was part of my job as director of research, is figure out where do we want to go? Where are men lost? And that takes a lot of archival research, interviews with veterans, that sort of thing, and then get the North Koreans to agree to let us go there. And that gets into their security concerns because there are a lot of areas that they really are not anxious to let us go to. But we would generally work those out. I'd say that the biggest concerns that we ran into and the things that, in addition to political issues that we had the most problems with, were that we had safety concerns for our own personnel in North Korea. And they had, I think, I wouldn't say they were legitimate security concerns in that I think they're legitimate, but I think they thought they were legitimate, that letting U.S. military and civilian DOD personnel into North Korea could present problems in a lot of ways they were worried about. So that was a constant problem. And in the end, in May of 2005, the Secretary of Defense announced that for security concerns, we were ending the joint recovery operations in North Korea, and they've yet to resume since then.
That actually leads well into my next question, which is, this is, of course, in the news again, right?
Yes.
And so you're talking about, you know, that has not resumed yet, but it might be resuming in some manner now. We should point out that we're not sure at this exact moment that we're recording this podcast what the outcome will be, whether the remains will have been returned yet or not. But we saw in the Singapore statement that came out after President Trump met Kim Jong-un, that was specifically included that they would return some remains of American soldiers. So I'm wondering, as someone who's specifically working on this issue, what was your reaction to seeing that in writing and in one of the only 4 points in the Singapore statement?
Well, my first reaction was I was really excited. I was really happy and pleased to see it in there. When I thought about it some more, I think it makes good sense, and it would have been a mistake not to be in there. And the reason I say that is it's been my understanding for many years. In fact, a young North Korean Ministry of Foreign Affairs official who was involved in some of the early negotiations on the joint recoveries, who's now the North Korean ambassador to the United Nations, pointed this out to me. And that is that in the initial contacts between our State Department and North Korea in the early 90s, I would think it would have been, we talked to the North Koreans about our set of preconditions to the normalization of relations between the United States and the DPRK. Top of the list was ending their nuclear program, but also in a list of about 5 items, as I understand it, was their cooperation on accounting for these missing men and assisting us in recovering them. And that, I think the North Koreans took that to heart. That was one of the things on their checklist because it was on our checklist, and since the 90s we gave it to them. So when I look at the Singapore agreement, it doesn't talk about normalizing relations, but in one place it says establishment of new US-DPRK relations, and another says development of new US-DPRK relations. So if that's part of the focus, obviously it is, of the Singapore statement, if we had not put in anything about remains, we would have changed a longstanding policy and the North Koreans would have taken note.
How do you see the repatriation process as it is moving forward at the moment? How do you see that being different, or is it different from when you were participating in resolving this issue? And do you see any new logistical or political difficulties that might be different than when you were working on repatriations?
You know, Jen, I think they're mainly the same. It's a surprise probably to no one who follows North Korea that the issues seem to go on and crop up again and again, sometimes in slightly different permutations, but it's basically the same issue. So most of the issues are there. They've gone back and forth over the years. I'd say there are a couple things that are a little different that I would like to highlight for you. I mentioned earlier that it was a U.S. government decision to stop those joint recoveries in North Korea out of safety concerns. So I think the situation, though those concerns are still there, but maybe the resolution of them is different. One might be easier. Another concern may be of even greater concern today. So the first concern that we had in 2005 was, what do we do if one of our American soldiers or civilians is injured and in serious need of medical attention right away in North Korea? And we had medics with us, but, you know, someone who needed immediate emergency room care, how would we do that? Well, the plan that we agreed to with North Koreans was to evacuate them quickly through Panmunjom to South Korea. But that requires pretty good communications and moving very quickly. And we just didn't have the communications then because the North Koreans were very concerned about letting us bring radios into North Korea. And good radio communications in those days were the only way to do this effectively. That was one of our big concerns. It's my understanding now that there's an internal cell phone network in North Korea. If that's the case, that would seem to be an obvious solution to that problem. I think there are many more technical solutions to the emergency medical evacuation problem today than there were 2005. Another safety issue, though, and this in our minds fell under the overall title of safety, was how safe are the Americans who went there, including when I was going there, from being arbitrarily arrested and imprisoned by the North Koreans? Looking back on it, maybe we were a little bit naive, but we just didn't think it was very likely that they would do that. So we didn't put anything specifically into the agreements or arrangements to get them to say they wouldn't do that. Now I don't know that it's so far-fetched that could happen. So I'm not trying to suggest what should be done about it, but I would assume the people who are negotiating this have that in mind and are looking for better protection against arbitrarily arrest and imprisonment of our people than we had in the past. So those are two things that I see that are significant and that have changed. The other thing I wanted to mention, I've talked about the unilateral recoveries and the joint recoveries. And how we asked the North Koreans to stop the unilateral recoveries because the identifications were so difficult when they did it, and the rate of identification much better when we'd go and do it ourselves. But the science has gotten so good, and the procedures and the knowledge of who we're working for created things like a special DNA database where DOD has gone out and found close living relatives of almost all of the missing men and got them to voluntarily give DNA samples so that we can match any remains against that special DNA database, that sort of thing. The remains identification for those unilateral recoveries, which we think, see, we don't really know exactly how many people we have there, but we think it's around 400. It's quite better now. It's running at about 45%. 181 of them have been identified to date, much better than we ever expected it would be. So that's something to keep in mind as we think, because as you mentioned, today is in Korea, the 27th of July. It's the 65th anniversary of the armistice, and there's been some reporting in the media that maybe the first of what's been referred to recently as 200 unilaterally recovered North Korean remains might be coming back today. We don't know, as we're doing this podcast, whether that'll happen or not, but the main thing is whether it happens today or it happens later, I'm optimistic that we'll get pretty good identifications out of that. The identification rates are much better for the joint recoveries. Two-thirds of all the people that we brought out of, all the remains that we brought out of North Korea during the joint recoveries have been identified. But we brought less people out. So the largest total number, 181, of identified remains coming out of North Korea was because of the unilateral. So both programs can work for us, and we need to keep that in mind, too.
Just a quick clarification question. I'm wondering, is the joint recovery slightly better identification rates in part because you saw where they were and you might know from archives who may have been lost spot?
That's exactly right. Yes, you're exactly right. And the problem with the unilateral recoveries coming from North Korea, particularly those in the early 1990s, there was inadequate information about when they had been recovered, where they had been recovered. A lot of the identification process starts with where were these remains found and therefore who could it be? Because in our archives, we have pretty good records of who was lost in what location. So losing that locational data can make the ID process much more difficult than it needs to be.
Right. So one thing I actually want to return to for a moment, because I think when we hear this in the news, you hear about 200 remains possibly being returned to the United States. I think sometimes we forget that those are 200 people. These are 200 fathers, sons, you know, family members. So were you able to interact at all with families who had their loved ones returned? Or do you have any stories that you would feel comfortable sharing about how important this is to families to have their loved ones identified?
That's probably the most important question of all. And the answer is yes. It was part of my job when I was in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, as it was the job of all my coworkers to deal with the families of the missing and explain what we were doing and try to help. So not only those that we were able to find their missing loved one, but those that we couldn't and still haven't found. So two, you ask about stories. So just two quick examples that I always think of. Two ladies who grew up without their fathers. One was the daughter of Lieutenant Colonel Don Faith, who was awarded the Medal of Honor, but died in the Chosun Reservoir, the Changjinho in Korean, when his unit was overrun by a Chinese force that outnumbered him 9-1, and he tried to lead his men to fight their way out, died in the process. As we brought the remains back from the Chosun Reservoir, we couldn't know as we were bringing them who they were. I mean, we had a long list of men missing in that battle, and we had remains, and that's all we knew. So we didn't know what the results would be. But as the experts at the labs worked this over the years, they found Colonel Faith. So I was able to go to Arlington Cemetery for his funeral, his being laid to rest, and saw his family there. So that was a really gratifying moment for me. The other story is the story of a lady whose father was an officer on a B-26 medium bomber that was flying very dangerous night missions over North Korea. The aircraft was shot down, and her father basically disappeared. No trace of him afterwards, although two other crew members were captured and spent the rest of the wars as POWs. She became very active in organizing the families and keeping this issue in front of the American people. We were able to take her to North Korea to observe one of her joint recoveries. And while we were there, we were able to take her just to the general part of North Korea, along the highways running north of Pyongyang towards the Chinese border. We didn't know the exact spot where her father had been lost. And had a brief memorial for him. And I think that we still haven't accounted for her father. So that's a great disappointment. So we see it both ways. We see it both ways. But the key point is that's that's why we do this work. It's for the families of the missing.
So this has been a really fascinating and, like I said, relevant discussion. We'll be watching very carefully to see how this plays out. Hopefully we'll see some tomorrow, the 27th, or shortly thereafter. But before we go, is there anything else that you want to add or any thoughts you want to leave us with?
Thanks, Jenna. Yeah, there are just two things that I'd like to mention. The first is I would like to put a plug in for the people in the Department of Defense who still work this issue. They're now called the Defense Prisoner of War Missing in Action Accounting Agency, and their initials are DPAA. So I'd encourage people who are interested in this issue to just Google those four letters, DPAA, go to their website and read more about it. You'll find all the statistics and all the background on this issue. It's really an excellent presentation. The other thing, having worked this issue and also followed other issues dealing with North Korea, that I think it's very important to keep in mind, certainly, as I explained, for North Korea, this is an international issue, and we've told them it has an important role in any hope they may have of having better relations with the United States. But for the United States, it's really not an international issue. This is a domestic issue. This is about the missing men, their families, and the veterans. So there's not an exact one-for-one comparison between the way we look at it, the way the North Koreans look at it. But But we should always remember why we're doing it, really. It's for Americans and the American people. Yeah, thank you.
All right. Thank you so much for taking your time and explaining some of these issues, because I think, like I said, we hear about it in the news lately, but I don't know if people know all the things that go into all the people who are working on this very, you know, spending a lot of time and energy to make sure that these families know where their loved ones are. So thank you for working on this issue for many years. And thank you for speaking to me about it here on the podcast.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks, everyone, for once again joining us here on Korean Context. I hope you enjoyed our conversation. DC is kind of winding down for the summer, but we actually have a lot of great content for August. So please do continue to listen to Korean Context. Make sure you're subscribed so you know when we post new episodes. And we'll see you here next week.